Hey, podcast listeners, it's Anne Strainchamps here from To the Best of Our Knowledge. And this week, we're bringing you a conversation with a young writer who's emerging as one of the great intellectual voices of our time. He's already being compared to people like Susan Sontag and Lionel Trilling, cultural critics with the intellectual breadth and curiosity to cover everything from high art to pop culture. So maybe you know him. His name is Mark Greif. He's been writing for 10 years or so, and some of his essays are famous. He's written memorably about the crisis of policing, the tyranny of food snobbery, the philosophical meaning of Radiohead, the rise and fall of the hipster, and his own inability to love hip-hop.
Yeah.
Weirdly, I saw all sorts of golden age hip-hop acts sort of by accident, and yet there was some barrier at the key moment when you kind of make a decision, what will I really give my heart to in my teen years? Well, in hindsight, you think those were world historical years. Here's this new art form being born. What's wrong with you, fellow? You know, is it racism? Is it being afraid to leave your house and go someplace different? Like, why didn't you become a kind of hip-hop head, a white hip-hop head? Which, of course, is itself embarrassing as a stance. So there's a challenge in how far you can go. If you say, you know, what I really want is not to be trapped in this horrible fiction of whiteness, well, you are trapped in it, you know?
Mark Greif is one of the founders of the literary magazine N Plus One, and he's just come out with a collection of his most influential essays called Against Everything. It's a finalist for a National Book Critics Circle Award. Mark was in town recently, and he and Steve Paulson got together to talk about the art of criticism and how Mark's been inspired by writers like Susan Sontag and Henry David Thoreau.
Mark, your collection of essays is titled Against Everything, and you have an essay called Against Exercise, another one critiquing contemporary foodie culture, another one on the problem of how we've come to think about sex in contemporary culture. What does it mean to be against everything?
You know, I took the title Against Everything in an extremely physical way. That is to say, I kept imagining what would happen if you actually pushed back on the things that you depended on day to day, your basic values. I go to the gym. Well, why do you actually go to the gym? Or I imagined it like biting a nugget of gold that you would find, I suppose, if you were a prospector, to see if it wasn't fool's gold. Seems like there's a lot of fool's gold in circulation at the moment. And with all these things, sex, exercise, food, and even, you know, later in the book, the kind of reality television shows I found myself watching, not quite understanding why I was obsessed with Naked and Afraid, you know, or the sorts of hipster worlds that emerged around me when I was sipping what just seemed to be a very satisfying cappuccino. I began wondering, am I doing these things for reasons that I would genuinely be proud of if I kind of followed them to the end? And these essays were written in my 20s and my 30s at a time when it seemed urgent to figure out, you know, how I was living, what I was living for. So that's how I imagined the against.
So you want to resist dominant culture in some way. That's my impression.
I guess so. I mean, I do feel kind of at the mercy of forces I don't understand. I don't know why everyone doesn't feel this way and just scream, like sitting in their cars. Even today, coming here, I can't believe the number of kind of offerings on billboards and buses, on the sack that like your lunch comes in from McDonald's, essentially telling you how you should feel, what you should care about, how much the McDonald's Corporation cares about you. It's sort of a hard thing to believe. Yeah, it does bug me to be kind of at the center of all these constant appeals and imperatives. So, I mean, that's sort of the way I thought about the book once it had come together. I looked at it and said, what have I done? I'm not a guru. I don't have good answers. And certainly I don't think of myself as a particularly special or unusual person. But, you know, in the realm of the ordinary, I thought, at this moment, what would it take just to be honest with yourself? Is that possible?
Hmm. Well, let's talk about one of these. The very first essay, I think it is Against Exercise. And you sort of make this fascinating connection, or you point out the great irony is that we've sort of imported some of the values from the old factory culture into the way we exercise. You know, all the high-tech equipment, all the way you can measure everything. You know, there are metrics to every little bit of exercise that we do. I guess the question is there anything wrong with this?
Well, I mean, you really pick on exactly the moment that got me started on it. I mean, the essay began in some sense when I was on a treadmill and I was watching my numbers change, and I was being, I thought, very polite, making sure not to look too much at the other people who were like sweating and grunting next to me on the other treadmills. And I just had one of those experiences of horror, you know, in a religious age.
why am I doing
it
this?
It would have been a vision. Well, first I looked around and I said, oh my God, that poor man, he's trapped, he's stuck to that pull-down machine, and look what it's doing to him. And then, yeah, I looked at another person, I said, and that guy, you know, in another age, very clearly he would be stamping out the hoods or fenders of, you know, automobiles, right, with this gesture. And I thought, oh my God, I'm among the damned. He is damned, she is damned, and I am damned. And I laughed with this kind of sinking feeling and said to myself, though, that's not an intellectual experience, right? But I said, well, here I am. I have a library and free time. You know, how did gymnasia work in Athens? Where did the gym come from in our culture, modern America? And especially, is there anything to the fact that, you know, something that we know is wise or prudent, let's say, that you get some activity, that you move. And I do think this is a kind of basic bodily need to move around in different ways. Does it matter that we do seem to wind up structuring it in ways that often look like old-time labor, but in the old days someone would actually be building a house or producing, you know.
Right, and so why are we going to all the trouble for our leisure activity?
And why is it this way? I mean, it's a funny thing to do, but I began imagining, like, could I imagine running that was not running the way we did it? And I started to think, well, you know, suppose you just ran until you were tired, or suppose you ran to someplace you genuinely wanted to go but didn't count. And I really did begin to think that counting, in a way, is the underlying overwhelming technology, let's say, of exercise as we know it. If you're not constantly saying, I'm going to get to 10 instead of 9, you're in a totally different domain. And, you know, there's the question, is there anything wrong with it? Especially as I went through all these different essays.
And do you still exercise?
No.
Oh, you don't? Okay, so that's interesting.
No, actually, I mean, it's a terrible thing. People say, well, do you practice what you preach? Have the things in this book changed the way you live? And certainly the easiest of them is, I never went back to the gym, actually, after that. But there are other nobler changes in life. That one wasn't so hard. But the one thing that I really think is crucial and would kind of stand behind is that it's not a moral activity. It's not the source of a morality to exercise, or indeed to kind of obsess about making sure that yours is the best lettuce.
But on the other hand, you're dissecting all these lifestyle choices, exercise, the kind of food that we eat, the music we listen to, the TV shows that we watch. And I mean, what I think most people would consider, you know, rather frivolous activities, I think you're sort of asking, why do we do this? You know, are these the right choices?
Yeah, I guess I think that those frivolous activities, when you add them all up and map them on the calendar of your week, they turn out to be your life for, you know, all of us in the richest nations and in the United States, and not just the rich people in the rich nations. I mean, I think dieting and certainly reality TV and a whole host of things that come up in the book do kind of belong to the vast we of Americans. And I guess that's one of the things that surprised me when I thought about it. I came to believe that actually we're kind of in a golden age, or in some ways a paradise that people imagined in terms of the ability to get our food easily, not to spend the whole day hoeing the fields, even to separate sexual desire from immediate pregnancy and childbearing, you know, the other sense of labor, to have to go through the labor of childbearing and child rearing. And yet, with all of this freedom and a kind of huge triumph of civilization, it's not clear that we're doing some of the things that philosophers imagined 1,000 years ago with our new free time, namely, you know, creating a better democracy or a more inclusive one, or genuinely creating a society of justice. So,
are you saying that we get caught up in the lifestyle choices? We give them more value than they really should have, and instead we should be talking about how to create a more equitable society?
I partly think yes. And, you know, this is a moment where I scare myself because I think, don't be a guru, proffer no answers, only because I feel like that's the very thing that gets you in trouble, to become fixed again. But I guess the way I've come to think about it is in terms of necessity. What are the things that are truly necessary for the individual at the level of the body and physiology? And what are the things that are necessary for society?
So you're calling for the examined life. You know, there are all these things we just do without even thinking about it. Let's unpack this. Let's figure out why we do these things. And of course, great writers throughout the ages have asked those questions. One was Henry David Thoreau,
yes,
who seems to be one of your touchstones. And you actually grew up near Walden Pond, didn't you?
I did. And there's a story about Thoreau in the book, or my relation to Thoreau. I mean, he is someone that I admire and who terrifies me because, you know, to genuinely read Walden and to read his writings is to find someone so implacable in insisting that you must stop and ask whether what you're doing is the thing you should be doing. And growing up near Concord, you know, there are all kinds of tourist sites, which is how I first encountered him. And a big preoccupation in Concord, Massachusetts, for everyone is the fact that he went home on weekends to do his laundry and have a family dinner from his hermitage at Walden.
He cheated, in other words.
Well, but
which isn't exactly in the book.
Yeah, but not to me. I mean, it's funny because people often take this as a kind of betrayal of the solitary project. And yet I really think to read Thoreau right, or I don't know, at least as I experience my pal Henry, he's a very funny guy as well as a sometimes, you know, sneaky one. And it's crucial that the railroad was right next to his house. It's crucial that the house that he built, he largely bought, you know, from a laborer on the railroad. It's crucial that he did go home every weekend and that his friends were always dropping by. I mean, I think the book is, in a lot of ways, much more teasing about what it would mean to figure out what, like, a deep and individual life would mean in the context of a regular society than we acknowledge. But anyway, the thing that's valuable, you know, about Thoreau in explaining this book is that I do have a real fear of seeming like I have figured out the right to be the person to examine everything and go around telling other people that their lives stink, you know.
But you are... You were a critic. I mean, that's this is a collection of essays of criticism, and isn't that what critics do?
There are different kinds of critics. I mean, and for me at least, I have always felt, in my writing, I've always felt I shouldn't criticize, you know, in both senses, things that I don't do. And not just because, you know, this would be wrong. I mean, there are plenty of things that stink that one should criticize, but because I felt I would get the wrong answers. It's important in talking about reality television for me and talking, you know, because people are often interested and they're like, oh, you wrote about reality television. How could you watch all that stuff? You must have been holding your nose, blah, blah, blah. And of course, no, that would have made it impossible to have had any of the sensations or intuitions that would be worth explaining. I mean, it just so happened that for 5 years of my life, I found myself compulsively watching every dating show that was available, you know, on the cheapest and worst channels. And luckily, there were a lot of them. Eliminate, Third Wheel, you know, Extreme Dating.
And why did you watch all these dating shows?
I didn't know. I mean, and that's...
Were you in the dating scene yourself?
I was not. I mean, and perhaps now we get into biography, but perhaps there was some envy of the these unattached maniacs who were, you know, switching off one another on the shows. But to me, I mean, that was exactly the question I asked myself. I was like, why am I watching these? Why do I enjoy them so much? And moreover, why do I feel like I'm getting something out of them? What would I get? And then I did make myself watch also the genres of reality TV that I didn't like, which other people do. Like, I didn't like the shows where people vote each other off the island. That would be Survivor. But having a way in, I felt like I could understand what was appealing about each of them. And to me, reality television, actually, I think it's one of the great genres of our time, in part because its very sleaziness and the fact that it's not respectable, I think, lets you see into parts of America, parts of the way that we imagine other citizens, and also parts of the way that we judge each other constantly that you just don't get in movies, you don't get it in proper documentary, stuff like that. But for me, that's the principle of truth or just being on the right trail, that there be something that bothers you so much that you have to try to get to the bottom of it, or you have to figure it out.
So what about the dating shows? I mean, what did you conclude?
Oh, you want to know the secret?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, thank God, not my secret. The dating shows themselves, well, the judgment was more key than I'd realized to a variety of these shows, and that in a way, you know, Judge Wapner, the People's Court, which I used to watch as a kid, like the reality show, is kind of much deeper in the structure of lots of other shows that we think of as fun. Like, you know, Jersey Shore, I think it was felt that people watched these Jersey Shore kids with contempt. Other shows, especially, you know, the sorts of critics who do hold their noses at the stuff, I think they imagine, well, the people who watch the Kardashians are all in love with the Kardashians, want to be the Kardashians. I don't think that's quite right. I began to feel that the ways in which people tried to seduce each other, but then were constantly judging each other and discovering masks and mystification and all this kind of stuff on the dating shows, really was more like parts of our everyday social world. And that some of those other shows, too, that what I called the shows of the microcosm, where they would all get on an island and have these like mock governmental or judicial processes, the shows of surveillance and kind of total knowing. Lately, I've been obsessed with the shows about the last dangerous work in America, you know, that all these things had to do with efforts to kind of picture America and then judge right and wrong, good and bad, the things that either we all do or that we view as like the kind of last vestiges of things we admired, like genuine productive work, or the things that both thrill and terrify us, as with the Kardashians, the possibility that one could make a life of splendor and leisure seeming to do absolutely nothing.
Hmm. Yeah. So most, maybe all of these essays, I'm not sure, originally appeared in the intellectual and literary journal N Plus One, and you are one of the founders of this journal. And correct me if I'm wrong, but my impression is that basically this journal was created a little more than 10 years ago by a bunch of friends, most of whom had gone to college together, right?
Yes, and friends and complainers, it should be said. Yes, because there's a way in which the genesis of the thing, it was, you know, people I'd known in college and friends of friends who would sit around in somebody's apartment and say, oh, these other magazines, they only talk about dead people. It's just, you know, another article about the greatness of Flaubert. I do think Flaubert is great. Another article about the greatness of Thoreau. You know, why not spend all your time trying to figure out if there's something great now? Blah, blah, blah.
But, I mean, but to give this the serious intellectual treatment of the kind of stuff we've just been talking about, you know, daily lifestyle things.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a funny thing now to feel as a young person, which I am not anymore. I am now properly in middle age and very, very proud of it. But so much of life intersects with the university. And you're trained in all these techniques of fine discrimination and judgment and everything else. And you get out into the world, discover that no one will employ you at the level even of what you could do. And so one option is to move to Brooklyn and become, or, you know, Silver Lake or anywhere and become a hipster, to use all of these techniques of, you know, knowing which is a good play of Shakespeare's to knowing which is like a good trucker hat to wear. Or we felt, surely you could apply all those same things to new writers, new music, new anything. I mean, the idea of N plus one as a title was just to say, at a time when we were in college and there was still a lot of talk about the end of history and the end of progress in the arts, come on, there had to be at least a next step in every art you could think of. And
so your mandate was what? To help us think about a better culture?
I mean, the mandate was in a way more selfish than that or smaller. It was to kind of help ourselves to, I guess, to write down the things that really worried us and try to find solutions. You know, it was a funny time because print had not quite collapsed, print journalism, and yet, you know, the thing that we could all do for money, not much, $100 or $200, was to review books or review albums or review movies. And yet, if you had thought about something deeply and you had a new idea, you still kind of had to pretend that your new idea had been inspired by, you know, the latest Don DeLillo novel, or a very great writer, the latest Spice Girls album, a not very great band, and this dates it. And we thought, well, if we're not, you know, if we're not going to be paid anyway, you know, and it doesn't cost much, it turns out, to make a print journal that looks like everything else. And actually, we were shocked at how inexpensive it is to make a magazine nowadays, initially, as long as you don't, you know, count on things like an office, phone, you know, personnel, anything like that, salaries. Yeah, why not just go for it? Why not write down the things directly and without preamble and without pretending that your own best ideas came from some other cultural thing that was more, you know, advertised or better funded.
So to some degree, this was a throwback to the old, great, small literary and intellectual journals, you know, Partisan Review, Dissent, Commentary, that had small circulation but outsized influence, especially on other intellectuals. And here you were, the Young Turks, planting your stake in the ground. You were gonna do it new.
I like the sound of this now. I like the energy of this. I mean, that was very much on our minds. And Partisan Review is a journal that, I mean, partly because I also, you know, I was becoming a professor. I was in grad school. But partly because I sat down in the library and read the whole run from 1936 to 1960 or something. That was an amazing journal. But also because we knew other people mythologized Partisan Review and loved it. When we did the magazine, it was very conscious. We thought, yeah, that was a moment where these small magazines talked to one another, fought about things. There was a real culture of argument, and they had a kind of outsized effect.
Hmm. Let me mention one of those old New York intellectuals, because your book is called Against Everything.
Yes.
And Susan Sontag wrote a famous book in the mid-60s called Against Interpretation, in which she called for an erotics of art instead of the usual sort of interpreting art as to, you know, figuring out what it means. Do you consider Sontag as kind of a model for the type of critic you admire?
I love Sontag. I mean, I love Sontag. I think if we had met, she would have been very mean to me. I admire Sontag, but yeah, and the, you know, the title is partly serious, partly satirical, partly an homage, but Against Interpretation is very much on my mind.
And of course, Sontag was this very glamorous figure as well.
Yeah, she was, which it's funny, you know, and this is different for me because when I first arrived in New York, you know, like, yeah, more than a decade ago, and finally was taken to lunch by like another child, essentially my own age, but one who had set herself up as a literary agent. She said, "What do you really want to do?" And I didn't know. She kept pressing me. And finally, I just blurted out, I said, "I want to be Susan Sontag." And she looked at me and she said, "Oh, no. That'll never happen." Which is true in a way. I mean, the glamour of Sontag does speak to people and her tremendous kind of haughtiness. And
so what was it that you liked about her as a critic?
What I have always admired about her, actually, I do think she too, well, she's not funny successfully in the way of Thoreau. Actually, Sontag is surprisingly unfunny, even when she tries. I guess what I liked about her is that she genuinely started from wherever she was, you know. I mean, famously, in the movie theater. She had just seen something, and she's like, "I understand it." Or she would look around and say, "Why do people call things camp?" and start from there. But I really admired, too, that she really knew her stuff. And this is something that it becomes a lot clearer now that her diaries have come out. I mean, she knew the canon of philosophy. She knew the canon of English literature. She knew infinite quantities of stuff. And yet, she didn't let it get in her way somehow. That is to say, if she had a problem and wanted to solve it, she would figure out exactly what resources of the culture she needed to bring up, exactly who she needed to quote, and she didn't care about proving that she knew Kant or proving she knew Freud and so forth. And that kind of just attack, I've always found thrilling. Mm. You know?
So I'm gonna play actually a couple of short audio excerpts from old interviews that I've done. Two old interviews.
Oh, amazing.
First is from Susan Sontag, now deceased, and this is from 1999. She had just come out with her novel, In America, and late in life, she had basically switched from being a critic to being a novelist, which is what we talk about here. You wrote an essay in 1963 in which you were quite critical of the traditional novel. You said that rereading Vanity Fair and Buddenbrooks made you wince, and quoting here, you wrote, "I could not stand the omnipotent author showing me that's how life is, making me compassionate and tearful." I assume you have changed your thinking since then.
Don't you think I'd be insane if I hadn't? you're quoting me. This is juvenilia. And do you realize it's almost 40 years ago?
But those essays were tremendously influential. A lot of people hung on every word.
Hey, I'm an American. I've reinvented myself.
So now you want to write novels that make people cry?
Absolutely. No, honestly, it is really hard to be nailed to what one wrote 35, close to 40 years ago. I mean, I must be, surely there's a way of being forgiven for having educated myself in public.
Do you still like to write essays?
No, not really. I think I could do so much more as a novelist, and if I have any ideas, and I have fewer and fewer ideas, I can put them in the novels.
So for you, it's the pleasure of creating imaginary worlds. That's far more interesting than, I guess you could say, writing polemics in an essay.
Absolutely. Oh, no question about it. I'm sick and tired of opinions, my own included, and I have fewer and fewer.
Okay. Susan Sontag from... What do you make of this? I mean, basically renouncing, you know, late in life, what had made her famous, what you admire, I think, as a young critic.
Well, it's wonderful, actually. I mean, that's it's both everything I believed about late Sontag and did not know and would have hoped for. The truth of Sontag, of course, is that by the 90s, she's not a very good critic. I mean, she doesn't write good essays anymore, but she does kind of come into her own as a novelist. I mean, it's an ideal trajectory in some ways if you can start out really hammering away at the world to try to figure out what things ought to make you cry and then get to a position where you can want to make people cry. That seems pretty good. I mean, I do also like, I just, that's incredible. That's an incredible interview. But I like how, I mean, she's a real person in that interview. She sounds very ordinary. And, you know, you speak of her glamour, which is, you see it in all the photographs. I think she was good at getting dressed up for photographs. But the only time I ever did encounter her in person, I was in a lecture hall and someone came in, you know, who sat down carrying these like big bags of books and papers and you know, and kind of frazzled. And I looked over and I was like, oh, that person kind of looks like my mom or me. Like, I know this person. And then, of course, I looked twice and I said, oh, God, it's Susan Sontag.
So speaking of the real person.
Yeah, like that's what an intellectual looks like, right, you know, too many books.
My guest is cultural critic Mark Greif, one of the founders of the magazine N Plus One, and the author of the new essay collection Against Everything. Just ahead, we'll talk about hipsters, David Foster Wallace, and why Mark feels compelled to write about the embarrassing parts of his life. Now, one of the things that you do in your essays is you show a little bit of courage in some of the things that you write about. For instance, you write about your personal failure growing up without an appreciation of hip-hop, which, as a white person, you feel kind of ashamed about. So you decide that you want to learn how to rap.
Yes.
I have to say the premise here is a little cringeworthy. You know, the grown white man who's going to learn about hip-hop. Yep. What was the idea here?
Well, there's a whole section of the book that I just think of as the embarrassing section when I summarize it to myself. And those were essays that had not been published in N Plus One, many of them. I thought they would only make sense in context. Those essays, especially about popular music, and some of the essays that fall under the rubric of the meaning of life, they are essays a little bit in embarrassment. I mean, I think there's a real utility for the individual, which we don't always acknowledge, of living in shame, you know, a little bit of mild shame, because there are some things that one should be ashamed about.
Well, why do you need to be ashamed about not growing up and liking hip-hop?
Oh, I guess because... well, it kind of matters to me. I mean, it matters to me to really think about what art is good or great. And what was funny, as it says in that essay, I intersected with all this stuff. I saw all sorts of golden age hip hop acts sort of by accident. And because of my dad's side of the family in Manhattan and the Lower East Side, I was at the right moment to be around people beatboxing in the park and so forth. And yet there was some barrier at the key moment when you kind of make a decision, what will I really give my heart to in my teen years, to hip-hop standing in for that. And I mean, you know, so I had my kind of fake punk rock affiliations also discussed in the book. But I had to ask myself later, well, in hindsight, you think those were world historical years. Here's this new art form being born. What's wrong with you, fellow? You know, is it racism? Is it being afraid to leave your house and go someplace different? Like, why didn't you become a kind of hip-hop head, a white hip-hop head, which, of course, is itself embarrassing as a stance. So, you know, the essay is partly about the kind of shame of lack of racial crossing, you know, as an American, or how far can you go? And on the other hand, as you say, the premise is cringeworthy because there's a challenge in how far you can go. If you say, you know, what I really want is not to be trapped in this horrible fiction of whiteness, well, you are trapped in it, you know. I mean, your fault.
So, how far did you go? I mean, did you teach yourself to like rap?
Oh God, well, that's not hard at all. Yeah, no, and I'd always liked it. But you know, that essay is funny. In some ways, it's to me the most academic piece in the collection, because it was only by simultaneously learning to do songs that I'd always loved but just couldn't do, and kind of understanding technically what the challenges are and the glories of rapping or emceeing, and at the same time sitting down in the library and reading a whole world of sociology and kind of economics of how Black Americans' occupational structure has shifted, how capital has been built up. There's suddenly all these things that were just like weird phenomena on the television news made historical sense, and the songs made historical sense. And also sometimes the things that when I was young were genuinely impossible to rap along to, songs about crack, songs about shooting deaths, songs about, you know, machismo and so forth. they made a kind of historical sense, or I understood a logic that continues to play itself out in an era of mass incarceration and all the rest that had just been like invisible to me. And
did you feel it almost in a moral imperative to be able to embrace hip hop?
Well, no. I mean, I guess not to sound like just an aesthete, but no, the real problem for me was that I can recognize here artworks which are genuinely, genuinely great. Why didn't I just like run around town shouting this? You know, that's the thing. It's actually it's the kind of honesty with yourself and also maybe the, what is it, like arrogance or pride of just wanting to be able to figure out what art is really good that drives that thing. Yeah. Mm.
Okay. There's another essay I have to ask you
about.
Please. Again, it almost invites a certain degree of eye rolling. What was the hipster? You know, it's sort of like almost doing a sociological analysis of what it means to be hip. Where do you want to go with that?
Well, that was a fun essay because it does have a very particular history. You know, I have this other life. Once upon a time, it was in grad school expecting unemployment, which helped inspire wanting to just write things that couldn't go in an academic journal. Now I'm actually employed as a professor. And when I first got that job at the New School in New York, they said, we want you to do public programming. We want you to do, and I said, God, what do I do? But I looked around, it was, you know, 2008, I think. And for some years, I had been wondering who these people were, the hipsters. You know, they were everywhere. They were in Williamsburg. They were in the Lower East Side.
Were you one of them?
I was not, actually. Yeah, at the time, people would sometimes challenge me. But, you know, you could just have looked at me then, and you would say, as my then-girlfriend, now wife, said to me once, she looked me up and down, she said, you're no hipster. You're not hip at all.
Of course, now hipster is a word of contempt. You know, you don't want to be called a hipster.
Well, it's become complicated, actually. I mean, because what happened was, public programming, I said, a little sense of mischief, I said, fine, I'm going to do a conference, a one-day conference at the New School, home of, you know, a glorious tradition in the social sciences, on what was the hipster. Because I figured nothing would annoy actual hipsters more than being told that they were dead and gone, that something had superseded them. Anyway, that essay, it does poke fun at the hipsters. But again, I looked around and in the neighborhood basically where my grandmother lived, I said, again, with some shame, I was like, this is strange. These stores that I knew, you know, it used to be kosher bakeries and hosiery shops and all this kind of stuff. Wow, they're now serving such delicious cappuccino that I love. And all the people here look like the people I knew in college. You know, I was a part of the problem, let's say, but also had some other vantage on it. And that essay really was just an effort to say, behind the pretense that hipsters can't be explained, that it's just a pejorative or something else, who are these people? Where do they actually come from? From what backgrounds? From what classes? With what attitudes? And then what are they doing to the city fabric? What does it mean that you can now, or then you could walk in New York and say, well, I'm now in, you know, I started out in the Orthodox Jewish neighborhood where my grandmother was, and now I'm in a Puerto Rican neighborhood. Now I'm in a Dominican neighborhood. Now I'm in the hipster neighborhood. Now I'm in Chinatown.
So you didn't want to just make fun of hipsters.
Oh, no. I mean, I certainly loathe them, which I think comes through. I think comes through in the piece, but, you know, but that's, I mean, this is the nature of much social diagnosis is you have to care enough to really despise a set of people or the reverse, despise people enough to care. I mean, by the end of working on it, I had, as happens in a lot of these topics, I did feel that I had come to understand, at any rate, how many different categories of people and social classes were coming together in this space of hipsterism and often beneath, you know, horrible level layers of pretense and pretension, they actually were kind of negotiating to work out, you know, how they could live together. And
why do you loathe hipsters?
Why did I loathe hipsters? I mean, it turns out when you get right down to it in this book, I've discovered it in myself. I knew it. I really loathe advertising and I really loathe the intrusion of the commercial, let's say, onto things that people do for free already and onto things that I think of as just kind of social or indeed artistic. Like I really believe in art. I kind of believe in greatness in art. And what troubled me about the hipsters is that it looked as if they were occupying this strange place, making a conduit between kind of real what I would think of as real subcultures, rebel subcultures, you know, the vegan anarchist bicycle messengers and the angry skate punks and the vegetarian, you know, well, I don't know what they are. In any case, they're between that world and then the world of basically such things as branding consultancies, high-end tourism, bars for Wall Street people to feel that they had not lost their teenage goth cred or whatever. I mean, so maybe this gets too particular. But I thought this is really quite poisonous because instead of making art, you have a realm of people making, you know, products with at the best some really nice fonts to sell to one another in a way that kind of crowds out what we would think of as an old bohemia of people doing stuff for free that's great because no one would know to pay them, you know. That was what troubled me, this kind of intrusion of an endless culture of commerce into really quite beautiful small-scale things that didn't have to be about money.
So there's a second piece of audio that I want to play. Okay. And this also comes from someone who's no longer living, from the late writer David Foster Wallace, who embodied, I think, the cult of the hip writer, you know, with all of his self-consciousness, his footnotes, his elaborate digressions. And this comes from an interview we did in 2004. I mentioned this essay that you wrote, I think it was back in 1993, about writing and sort of what various fiction writers are up to. And one point you made is that irony tyrannizes us. The implicit message of irony is, I don't really mean what I'm saying. And you went on to suggest that the next generation of rebel writers might ditch irony in favor of sincerity, and I think I'm quoting here, who treat plain old untrendy human troubles and emotions with reverence and conviction, who eschew self-consciousness and hip fatigue. And I guess...
Yeah.
is that a critique of your own kind of writing?
I don't know that it's that. I mean, the thing even sounds dated to me now. I think it's less that than an articulation of the thing you were asking me about before is, you know, what is it like to be working really hard on the stuff at age 42, having been marketed to all your life? I mean, because you want your art to be hip and seem cool to people. You want people to like the stuff. But a great deal of what passes for hip or cool is now highly, highly commercially driven. Some of it, I think, is important art. I think The Simpsons is important art. On the other hand, it's also, in my opinion, relentlessly sort of corrosive to the soul, and everything is parodied and everything is ridiculous. Maybe I'm old, but for my part, I can be steeped in about an hour of it, and then I sort of have to walk away and look at a flower or something. If there's something to be talked about, that thing is this weird conflict between what my girlfriend calls the inner sap, you know, the part of us that can really wholeheartedly weep at stuff, and the part of us that has to live in a world of smart, jaded, sophisticated people and wants very much to be taken seriously by those people. I don't know that it's that irony tyrannizes us, but the fashions that are so easy to criticize but are so incredibly powerful and authentic seeming when we're inside them tyrannize us. I don't know that it's ever been any different. That probably makes absolutely no sense.
No, it actually makes total
sense. That was my experiment at telling the truth.
It makes total sense. But can you hold those two impulses simultaneously?
No, but I think my personal opinion and what I tell my students is that if there's suffering involved in art or however you want to say it, right now this is the form of the suffering, is to be the battleground for the war between those two kind of impulses, neither of which are stupid, neither of which are wrong. But it's not at all clear to me how to marry them. And I don't think it's been at all clear since about the 1950s. And I just think it's where we're at.
Okay. So that was David Foster Wallace back in 2004. Do you agree with him? Or are we caught in a trap of irony?
What an amazing piece of audio. I mean, again, it's funny. Listening to that, it makes me feel part of a tradition or something. I mean, because, you know, when N plus one was started, for example, we were very, very conscious of this story, which I believe to be true, about irony, that we had lived in an ironic age and so forth. But I felt, yeah, people did not necessarily understand it or write. I mean, I think what Wallace says, again, is what I thought was going on, let's say, with his generation of writers, that this business of irony and of not being able perhaps to just say things straight or to utter the kind of most earnest and true words in their natural form, it came about precisely because the words that mattered most had already been kind of stolen from your mouth by advertising and by television that they had been, you know, evacuated of meaning. And insofar as there is a kind of generational turn for us, there was a very conscious feeling, and maybe it was, you know, coming of age in a slightly different moment culturally of really profound lying. This was the moment of the Iraq War, and also of really no expectation of ordinary jobs, right? The age of disruption had already started. But to just say, well, just say it, actually, that, you know, the only response to a world in which your words have been stolen from you is to kind of take them back and see what happens if you say the most serious thing in the most serious fashion. Even when people say, oh, you're not serious, people don't say it like that anymore, that's old-fashioned, etc. And, you know, Wallace actually, I mean, he was a real inspiration, and he, the first couple of years, I mean, N+1 was like not a real, it was a fake magazine. That was the premise. We, as long as the physical thing, the paper thing, looks like other magazines, then maybe people will not care that there's nothing fancy behind it, nothing professional behind it. But Wallace sent us Christmas cards each year in the early years. There wasn't much on them, but I mean, literally, they were, you know, they would say Merry Christmas and Peace on Earth, and he would just like write a little note, like, you know, good issue or something, and it was very meaningful.
But I mean, it seems to me you have embraced earnestness as opposed to being sort of embarrassed about it. I mean, it seems to be partly what you do, and a certain degree of moral seriousness that perhaps had gone out of fashion for an intellectual.
Maybe. I mean, the way in which I would express it to myself is the principle of just say it, you know, just say the thing that you actually feel in your heart, say the thing you mean. And I think it helps to feel a little bit ordinary to do it. You know, it's funny, I came to believe in, a real philosophy of the ordinary, of ordinary life. This is what's good about America. This is what's good about democracy, that you can kind of be free to have a private world that's not constantly intruded upon. You can have a political life and an unpolitical life and step away. And that, to me, too, gets to the principle of the just go ahead and say it. Because I began to look at myself and I thought, God, you're just like everybody else, you know? You're not a hipster. And you're ordinary. And you know what? Well, then why not you? You know, this is a kind of democratic principle. But, you know, the passage of Emerson, much quoted for the past 150 years, in which he says, say the word that's in your inmost heart, and it will be the word known to all men. If you don't, you'll only find your own words and thoughts given back to you with a certain alienated majesty from other people. It's the thing I try to keep in mind, that there's simply no reason not to try to say the best thing you can, let's say, or the most meaningful thing you can, especially when you do genuinely know that you're enough of a kind of conformist or enough inside the practices that everybody maintains to really know them, to really know them from the inside.
Mark, this has been a real pleasure. Oh, thank you.
Pleasure for me. Thank you.
That's great. Thanks.
Great.
Yeah.
That's Mark Greif talking with Steve Paulson. Mark is one of the founders of the literary magazine N+1. His new collection of essays is called Against Everything. It's a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. I'm Anne Strainchamps. If you like conversations with writers and scientists and cultural critics, check out To the Best of Our Knowledge. You'll find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you download your favorite podcasts. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin, and it's distributed by Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.